Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Civil Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, October 28, 2016, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's telephone conference call on race-based admissions, student lawsuits against Harvard and UNC. My name is Nate Kaczmarek. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Today, we welcome our expert, Will Consovoy, partner at Consovoy McCarthy Park, PLLC. He is the lead attorney for Students for Fair Admissions. Today, I will turn it over to Will to get us started. Following opening remarks, we will open the floor for questions. Thank you for speaking with us. Will, the floor is yours.
Great. Thank you very much, and I appreciate the chance to talk to the group about our cases. What I thought I would do is spend a few minutes giving you some general background about the cases and then an update on where we are in the litigation, and then happy to answer any questions anybody might have. To begin, these lawsuits were brought by an organization called Students for Fair Admissions. SFFA is a broad-based group. It is dedicated to ending racial preferences in higher education. It has roughly 22,000 members from across the country. If you're interested in learning more about SFFA or its mission, it has a website which offers a lot of detail about its activities. Among SFFA's members are students who have been denied admission to many universities, but in particular Harvard and the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Those students believe that they had been discriminated against on the basis of their race, and SFFA, through our law firm, brought litigation in 2014 against both Harvard and UNC. There is some overlap between the cases, but there are some differences too, so I'd like to give a little background about the nature of the allegations in those cases. Beginning with UNC Chapel Hill, the principal allegations in that case are that UNC is not taking advantage of an available, workable, race-neutral alternative. In fact, UNC wrote in its own report during the Fisher litigation that it had studied the issue and determined that if it went to a top 10% plan, which is a plan that allows automatic admission to high school students in North Carolina who graduate in the top 10% of their class, it would actually increase the overall racial diversity of the university. Notwithstanding that fact, UNC said that it would not be switching to a race-neutral system for various reasons, including that it would marginally lower the average SAT score of their entering class. So given that report, we believe that they were in violation of the 14th Amendment, brought the suit. In addition, the lawsuit has claimed that UNC is making race too big a factor in the decision-making process for admission. Under the Supreme Court's decision in Grutter v. Bollinger, race may be a non-predominant, quote-unquote, plus factor in the admissions calculus. Based on our investigation and as alleged in the complaint, that is not the case at UNC, that it is often a significant factor in the admissions decision. As the case develops, there may be additional arguments raised, but those are the two key arguments SFFA has brought against UNC. The Harvard case raises those allegations that Harvard is not taking advantage of race-neutral alternatives. Because it is a private institution unaffiliated with the state of Massachusetts, the race-neutral alternative there, we allege, is socioeconomic preferences as opposed to racial preferences. We also allege that Harvard is not using race as merely a plus factor, but as a dominant factor in the admissions criteria. But the lead claims there, and the ones that differentiate it from the UNC lawsuit, is the claim that Harvard is intentionally discriminating against Asian American applicants. And that breaks out into two counts in the complaint. One, that this is invidious discrimination against a racial minority group, very similar to the history of discrimination that Harvard had against Jewish applicants in the 20s, 30s, 40s, and into the 50s, that they simply are capping the number of Asian Americans who they will admit, notwithstanding their overall qualifications for admission. And second, that Harvard is engaging in racial balancing, meaning that it is trying to set up a class that is a certain percentage or range of each racial and ethnic type in the class. The Supreme Court, in many cases, but most recently in a case called Parents Involved, said that racial balancing is patently unconstitutional and violates the 14th Amendment. Harvard, although a private institution, is subject to Title VI of the Civil Rights Act because it accepts federal funds, and the Supreme Court in Grutter interpreted Title VI to be coextensive with the 14th Amendment. So if you violate the 14th Amendment, you're violating Title VI, and that's what's been alleged against Harvard. As I briefly mentioned, those lawsuits were first filed in 2014, and they were eventually stayed in light of the Supreme Court's decision to grant certiorari a second time in Fisher versus University of Texas, and ultimately have been stayed until the Supreme Court issued its decision in what's been known now as Fisher 2. As many people on the call may know, Fisher 2 ended with the Supreme Court upholding the University of Texas's use of race in admissions. While that was a disappointing outcome for all of us involved in it, I do think it's important to note how unusually narrow the Supreme Court's decision and discussion of the issue was. The Supreme Court went out of its way to say that the case had been brought by a single plaintiff alleging discrimination that dated back almost 8 years, that the record had become stale, that Texas had not produced the kind of data that would have allowed the court to have a more thorough review of its use of racial preferences. And for those reasons and others, it referred to the decision as sui generis and one that is unlikely to give guidance in future cases, including even any potential future litigation about Texas itself. So as I said, it's hard to imagine a decision more narrow, although again disappointing, than the Fisher 2 opinion. Once that opinion came down, the stays in both the UNC litigation and the Harvard litigation were lifted, and the cases have begun again. So where are we now? We are beginning to engage in discovery. In both cases, the parties filed answers. They did not move to dismiss. There has been some procedural skirmishes in the Harvard case over the organization's standing. There was an early ruling by the court finding that there should be no issue with respect to the association's standing, but it is still being litigated in the district court. Notwithstanding that, the parties have begun to engage in discovery. The court has granted what I would describe as extensive discovery in the case. The court has afforded SFFA the right to review 8 years of admissions data from Harvard. The court has allowed SFFA to review electronic communications that are potentially relevant to this litigation and has afforded SFFA the right to review those communications from no less than 24 Harvard employees. And notably, the court has said that SFFA will have no less than 20 depositions it will be allowed to take in the case. And that's in addition to any expert depositions that there are going to be. So I think it's fair to say that is extensive discovery. The discovery itself is under a protective order, at least temporarily. And so I will be unable to answer any questions about the nature of the documents or materials that are being produced. But I can talk about it in general terms, and I will try to answer any questions I can. UNC, although is still working its way through the process, is likely to end up with discovery of similar scope to the Harvard case, with similar access to data and electronic communications and depositions. So those discovery schedules are likely to last for the next 10 months or so. That may be adjusted depending on the party's needs and the ability to complete depositions. That will be followed by several months of expert discovery and expert depositions. And then ultimately, more than a year from now, we will likely be at a place where the parties will be pursuing summary judgment. So I would say that we are approaching more the end of the beginning than the beginning of the end of these cases. But From our perspective, we are encouraged and obviously excited to engage in discovery and learn about what these schools are doing. But litigation takes some time, and so we may not be returning to court on the merits of these cases for some time, perhaps over a year at least. So that, Nate, is where we are with the cases, generally speaking. With that brief overview, I'm happy to take questions and answer anybody's questions they have.
Okay, very good. Thank you for that overview. I will now open the floor for questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, please enter star, then the pound sign on your telephone. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound sign on your telephone keypad. Will, it looks like we have a question. Let's go to that right now.
Great.
Hi, Will. This is Roger Clegg with the Center for Equal Opportunity. How are you doing?
Hi, Roger.
Listen, congratulations and kudos to you and your law firm for the great work that you've been doing. This is really a great service in favor of the principle of a pluribus unum and truth, justice, and the American way. And I'm just delighted
Well, thank you, and thank you for all you're doing for the cause as well. Of course, we wouldn't be able to do it without you, so I appreciate that.
You're very kind. I was going to ask you. I hope this isn't. I hope this is in your wheelhouse, but I just saw in some news stories today about yet another lawsuit that you all, I think, are involved with against the Education Department regarding its failure to respond in a timely way to FOIA requests involving Princeton's use of racial preferences. Is that
That's
correct?
Right. That's right.
Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, of course. So the Students for Fair Admissions filed a FOIA request with the department, as you noted, seeking the documents that were produced by Princeton to the department when it was responding to a allegation, I think, that's quite similar to the one we've made against Harvard, that is discriminating against Asian Americans. The department exonerated Princeton in that study, but of course, as an organization, we would be very interested in reviewing those documents and potentially drawing our own conclusions about what's going on at Princeton. So we filed a FOIA request. The complaint's publicly available. I won't bore everyone with the details, but essentially, we've been asking for the documents for many months. They haven't been produced. We believe we're entitled to them, and so we were left with no choice but to bring the lawsuit. Mike Connolly from our firm is taking the lead on that one. We look forward to hearing their response to our allegations and hopefully getting those documents as quickly as we can.
Well, that's great. I think it will be very interesting to see, parallels between what's going on at Princeton, what's going on at Harvard, particularly if there's discussion, between the various universities about their respective uses of racial and ethnic preferences. I think
I agree. That would be interesting. And I would note if anyone wants to look at our Harvard complaint, in there at some point we list all of the Asian American admissions numbers over a period, I believe, of 10 years. It's been some time since I worked on the complaint, so I may have that slightly wrong. And what was always I found remarkable was how not only were the numbers consistent within each school, so Harvard was, 18%, 18%, 18%, 18% every year for a very long period of time, when even just random chance would lead to some variation in the numbers, and at a time when Asian applicants were skyrocketing. But the numbers were that across the Ivy League, Yale, Dartmouth, even Princeton to a slightly lesser extent, but also as well, just remarkably consistent. So to your point, we think there may be some worthwhile information in these documents, and we're looking forward to seeing it.
Keep up the good work.
Thank you very much. You too.
All righty.
Will, just to piggyback on that question, is it your impression that you were saying that they were consistent among the universities? Is it your impression that these universities have all gotten together and picked a certain number that applies to each one, or just that it's a consistent number each year at these universities?
You know, I'm not in a position to know quite yet, you know, why those numbers were so similar. I certainly am interested in finding out, you know. All I could do at this juncture is note that they have been. Hopefully, you know, as we learn more, whether through the Harvard suit, the Princeton FOIA, or other action by SFA or, you know, other like-minded organizations, that we may learn why that is. But as of now, I would probably be premature for me to try to hazard a guess.
Okay, very good. Looks like we have another caller ready with a question. Let's go to that call now.
Hi, let me add my my thanks and congratulations to the work you've been doing. This is Kurt Levy of FreedomWorks and the Committee for Justice. I know this is hard to do, given how vague some of these opinions have been, and given the sui generis nature of Fisher too. But could you state where you think the law stands currently? And by that I mean, what do you think one would have to show to win a case like this in a court that was, you know, doing its best to follow what the Supreme Court has said?
That's a great question, and as you noted, the opinions have been quite vague, and so I'm guessing a little bit myself at this point. I think, as I read the law, Fisher 2 left the law, quote unquote, as it was in Fisher 1, meaning that the focus of the jurisprudence, at least through the Fisher litigation, was when do you have an available race-neutral alternative and when do you not? We thought Texas did. The court in Fisher 2 didn't disagree with the test we applied because it came from Fisher 1, but for various reasons felt that we couldn't show enough that Texas had failed to take advantage of them. And so I think there is some room to wonder what kind of showing is necessary on that front. What I think makes Harvard somewhat different is that we are moving in a different aspect of the racial preferences case law. We're moving more toward a decision like Bakke, going back to the 70s, where the court said quotas are out. And to my mind, there is no doubt on the law on this issue. It's simply a matter of proof whether Harvard is engaging in those quotas or not. And if they are, I think the big question becomes, okay, other than stopping Harvard from engaging in them, what does that tell us about the nature of racial preferences, and does it raise more fundamental questions? We think it does. Harvard, for those who don't know, holistic admissions, which has been held up as the paradigm now through the Grutter case, began at Harvard. As our complaint alleges, it began as a means of discriminating against Jewish applicants. Harvard used to use an entrance exam, switched to holistic admissions as a means of keeping Jewish, otherwise qualified Jewish applicants out. And if it is true that, you know, half a century later, Harvard is using holistic admissions to achieve the same discriminatory system against Asian American applicants, I think that tells us something is deeply wrong here. And so instead of working at the edges of the jurisprudence, which I think where Fisher may people may disagree about what it means at those outer edges, I think these cases, in particular Harvard, may try to cut to the heart of the matter and avoid some of those skirmishes.
Now, where do you think the dividing line is between quotas, which, you know, I would agree if the court were to find it to be a quota, they would strike it down, and critical mass, which, you know, seems to be okay?
Sure. So, fair question. Critical mass is supposed to be defined, you know, not by a specific percentage. Obviously, there was a debate both at the podium in Fisher 1 and Fisher 2 and in the opinions about what that means. And there's a there appears to be a segment of the Supreme Court that thinks that critical mass is just a euphemism for a quota, and Justice Kennedy and others think that it is achievable without engaging in quotas. Actually, in Grutter, he didn't think that, but he may be open to it now. It's unclear. What I think everyone should agree is, even if you can come up with some numerical basis for underrepresented minorities, if you are then limiting the number of Asian American applicants vis-a-vis non-minorities, there is no defense under the critical mass rubric for that kind of behavior. And if that's what's going on, if Harvard and UNC, to the extent that the discovery shows that it's doing it, is establishing a target for each racial category, including those outside of the underrepresented minority segment, that's quotas under anybody's definition, and that's unconstitutional.
Thanks, Will.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, a reminder, if you want to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound sign on your telephone keypad. Will, it looks like we have two callers lined up. Let's go to the next call right now.
Great. Hi, this is Paul Salamanca at the University of Kentucky, and thank you very much for speaking with us today. I want to take a step back, if I might, from Grutter and from Fisher and look at them from a little bit of a distance. Reading those two opinions, Justice O'Connor's opinion in Grutter and Justice Kennedy's opinion in Fisher number 2, I see language in there that appears to me, divorced from context, to validate what you, I think, would describe as racial balancing. There are references in there to we want the upper echelons of our educational system to be visibly open to people from different backgrounds. And it seems to me that if you really probe on that, it's not about critical mass and it's not about a holistic system of admissions, and it is in fact about racial balancing. Given that language being in the majority opinion in Grutter and being in the majority opinion in Fisher number 2, and given the fact that the Supreme Court quite possibly is trending left on these things over the next few years because of personnel changes, is it possible that the court's not simply going to say, when the case eventually gets to them, we are exhausted with this issue, we are exhausted with mincing words, we are exhausted with the whole concept of Bakke, it's okay to engage in some kind of racial balancing? And if they get to that, first of all, do you see that is a possibility? And if they are going in that direction, how would you be prepared to respond to it?
Sure. I appreciate the question. Obviously, it's hard to anticipate what the court's going to look like for anybody right now. But I take your point about the potential for it to shift away from those who have been critical of racial preferences. I also take your point that this was a criticism that Justice Kennedy leveled against Grutter, that it was essentially an excuse for racial balancing in his dissent in that case. And I might push back a little bit on where he is on this, only because in Parents Involved, he was very strong against the idea of what looked like fairly obvious racial balancing there. So, to take the question on its own terms, if the court, we were confronted with an argument from the court that should it simply get out of this and allow racial balancing, I think our response would be, on a legal level, obviously you'd be overturning a ton of precedent. You'd be fundamentally rewriting 14th Amendment jurisprudence, number one, that they can do it, but I think it would be quite a radical transformation to do so. But more to the point, I think it's important, and in what a case like Harvard shows, what that means. This is not an abstract concept. Is it okay if it's proven? It hasn't been proven yet. Is it okay if Harvard is allowed to simply say, we only want so many Asian Americans for, you know, certainly our clients and our members are, and certainly many others come from our first generation American, have worked hard. Their families own small businesses. They have had no, breaks, no upper hands in society. They've worked very hard. And the question is, what have they done to be discriminated against in this way? And I would be surprised if any Supreme Court says, I mean, you look at opinions going back to Yik Wo over a century ago, that it is okay to limit Asian Americans or to limit Jewish applicants or limit any category because we simply don't want too many of them. If a court, and again, I don't think any court would do that. If a court does do that, I think then it becomes an issue for the American people, and we will certainly know, we will no longer be hiding behind words like critical mass, and we will know where everyone stands, and it will be up to the people to democratically, you know, decide whether they're okay with that. And that,
so I take it that I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, please, I'm done. Yeah.
I take it that. I mean, from the sound of it, you've given a lot of thought to the position that you might take that presents the best pitch from a point of view, let's say, of not only black letter law, but also moral philosophy and public appeal. And so you essentially, your thinking is that the court would be in a position where it would, the optics of not adhering to their own precedent would be too hard for them. So they would at least adhere to their own precedent, which gives you walls within to work where the odds are more in your favor. I take it that's what you're saying.
Yeah, whether it would be simply too difficult practically, or simply that, you know, even though they disagree with us on many issues, that in the liberal tradition, that Asian Americans are a minority and they cannot be discriminated against. And I'll assume that the belief in that is genuine. And I think if you genuinely believe that, then you have a hard time rejecting our arguments.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Will, we have two callers currently waiting. Before we go to their call, I just want to make one programming note. Our next Teleform conference call will be a special Courthouse Steps edition this Monday, the 31st at 2 p.m. We'll be discussing the Supreme Court oral arguments in Star Athletica versus Varsity Brands. That case involves a copyright protection dispute over cheerleading uniform designs. Again, if you'd like to get in line to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound sign on your phone. Let's go to the next question.
Hey, Will, this is Michael Tenenbaum in Los Angeles. Thanks for your work on these cases. I had two quick questions. One is, has there been any breakdown in the complaint, in the allegations of the complaint, or any of the data you've seen in the different types of Asians? I mean, that's a giant category, and I know lots of Indian people, for example, identify as Asians. And then I know within people that we would traditionally think of as Asians, you know, there are different preferences given to boat people from Vietnam as opposed to, you know, third generation Korean Americans, for example. And I'm wondering if there's been any allegations about that, if you've gotten into that level of nuance. And then the second question I had was, assuming the students themselves are not the ones funding the lawsuit, if the backers of these cases have identified themselves or care to identify themselves, and if that's, you know, something that's, you know, kind of publicly out there for us to know.
So on the first question, I can talk about the complaint. In the complaint, we do make the point that Asian American is a broad category that encompasses people from many different experiences and regions of the world. And that is an issue that has been raised both in this case and was raised in the Fisher case as well. What we have seen or have not seen within data that's been made available in the case, I can't comment on because of the protective order. So I can't get into what we have or have not seen there. And on the second question, that is information that is not publicly available, and I'm not in a position to get into that either.
Fair enough. Thanks.
Yep. Thank you for the call.
Okay, let's go to our next caller.
Hi, this is Will Trackman at Littler Mendelson in Denver. Recently, there was a news story about an African-American woman on a plane, and there was a guy who was choking, and she said, "Hey, I'm a doctor, let me help." And the flight attendants didn't believe her that she was a medical doctor. And I'm wondering whether there's some impact to minority students that might maybe give the moral high ground a little bit more. I know we often have a lot of non-minority students saying, well, it made it harder for me to get into the school because of the race preference. But is that the wrong injury in fact? Maybe there's an injury in fact that a minority student suffers because a school has a race-based admissions preference. What do you think about framing the injury that way?
So, great question. I don't think we've thought of it in terms of injury in a purely Article III injury in fact sense, but we certainly have talked about the issue as one of the costs of racial preferences. In the Supreme Court's jurisprudence on race-neutral alternatives, it makes pretty clear, I think, that you need to look at both the benefits of them, if there are any, but also the costs, and it's not costless. Justice Kennedy made the point that it's not costless on a sort of macro level in terms of race relations and our ability to progress as a society, that they may hold us back. But also, and I think Justice Thomas made this point in his Fisher 1 opinion, that there can be a stigmatizing effect, that there is an assumption that a minority who was admitted to a particular university was admitted on the basis of their race as opposed to their qualifications and abilities. It's an issue we've raised that's been raised in amicus briefs. It's certainly been an issue that was raised in Fisher. It's certainly an issue that the organization cares about as well.
Okay, if you would like to ask a question, please enter star, then pound on your telephone keypad. The lines are currently wide open. Just a reminder to keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming Teleform calls. You can also consult the full schedule of upcoming Teleform calls on the Federalist Society's website, fedsoc.org. Also available there are a podcast of previously recorded Teleform calls you may have missed. Okay, we have two callers now waiting. Let's go to the next call.
Yes, hello. Thanks very much for doing this call today. This is Kevin Mooney with the Daily Signal at the Heritage Foundation. In reviewing the concurring opinion of Justice Thomas, which I guess now is the dissenting opinion, he makes the argument that the proponents of diversity and racial balancing are essentially invoking the arguments of the old segregationists going back several decades, which I think is a pretty powerful argument. I'm just wondering if that's something that you might expect to be flushed out in perhaps in your case and other upcoming cases. And I just think that's something that has gotten a little bit lost and overlooked, and I'd like to think that could be, you know, pushed a little bit more aggressively.
Yeah, it's a fair question and a good point. I think as a historical matter, Justice Thomas marshaled pretty strong evidence that he's right. I think going all the way back to, I believe, the Iowa Supreme Court post-Reconstruction, you know, had a very different view of these things and rejected these kinds of arguments for the reasons you stated. At this point, obviously, we're still in district courts, and district courts are bound, of course, to apply the Supreme Court's decisions and not revisit them. And so we are strictly limiting our arguments at this juncture to winning under the existing precedents. But we have included in our complaints a count to overturn precedent. And when and if we reach, appellate review in the Supreme Court, certainly those arguments will be on the table, and I think Justice Thomas has been a powerful voice on those issues and has made many of the right arguments. So I think at the right time, those issues will be raised again.
Okay, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Okay, Will, we'll move to our next caller.
Hi, Will. This is Warren Belmark calling with what might be a question that's already been answered, but it was sort of raised by one of the prior questioners, and it has to do with the definitions of race and minority. Do the universities identify what they consider to be the categories that fall within the definition of race and fall within the definition of minority? and then in efforts to provide for the desired balancing, do they then balance within those minority groups as well, or is it just
anyone from any group
that's within the broad definition, which isn't broken down, they consider themselves to have satisfied their objectives?
Right. So, and I apologize for being repetitive, but with respect to anything I may or may not have learned throughout the course of these cases, I can't reveal it right now because we're under a protective order. But I can speak more broadly to the question. In Fisher 1, this came up at oral argument. The Chief Justice asked counsel for the University of Texas about how it determines whether someone is or is not within a minority group. And I believe the answer boiled down to the student self-identify. Most of the universities are using broad racial categories, such as African American, Asian American, Caucasian.
Jewish?
I don't think that's listed as a racial category, but I can't speak to every university. To some degree, they're all independent in terms of these things. So, again, it's an issue that we've raised in our complaints about how they're deciding which racial categories exist, how broadly they define them, what kinds of distinct populations they're essentially lumping together, and how they're granting preferences to some, not others. For example, in the Fisher litigation, the University of Texas identified Hispanic as an underrepresented minority, and Asian American as not an underrepresented minority, and we always struggled, and I believe Justice Alito mentioned this in his dissent, I could be wrong, that it was difficult to understand why that was so, given the demographics of that state. So you're right in identifying the question. I don't think we've reached the point where we know all the answers yet.
Well, it would seem to me that if one is within the definition of race, then that helps in determining what the proper balance would be. And if someone is outside the definition of favored racial groups, that would help to figuring out what the proper balancing target would be for an institution following that practice. And
sure.
It seems to me that until they do identify the universe that they're measuring, it becomes impossible to defer to their judgments as to how they've achieved the balance that they say they're trying to achieve.
Right, right. No, I appreciate your thoughts. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we now have two callers waiting in line to ask a question. If you would like to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound sign on your telephone keypad. Let's go to the next call.
Hi, this is Corey Liu from Houston, Texas. I was wondering to what extent maybe just talk about the Fisher litigation, that the data show that Asians are actually treated worse than whites, in which case you could flip the argument, sort of change the narrative and say, in a way, that whites are benefiting from affirmative action because the standards for them are lower than Asian Americans.
Right. Thanks for the question, Corey. I think the Texas data did show that. I think we did make that point that Asian Americans were among the most discriminated against, the most discriminated against group. And to the extent that anyone is benefiting because of discrimination against them, that's inappropriate. So, yeah, we haven't. Our point is not to make this necessarily about who are necessarily the winners and the losers in all this. We think everybody's a loser ultimately in the use of racial preferences, but we certainly haven't shied away from noting where Asian Americans are receiving worse treatment than non-minorities and raised it when we see it.
Yeah, I think it's obviously just strategically sort of changes the narrative some when, you know, in terms of black and white is a typical way, like Justice Sotomayor never mentions Asian Americans in her dissent. I think, you know, it's obviously to the extent you can show that with the data, then, you know, that's why the current SFFA litigation is, you know, very well designed, I think, to sort of highlight that.
I appreciate that.
Okay, thank you, caller. We have currently one person waiting to ask a question. If you would like to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound sign on your telephone. Go ahead, next caller.
I'm looking at your complaint, by the way, which is very well done. You note the common application asks people to identify by race and then ask them how they self-identify. Are you aware, I mean, is there anything that prevents an Asian student from identifying themselves as African-American and self-identifying as African-American? And are you aware of any situations where a student has done that and then after admission the school has challenged their either self-identification or their racial identification?
So on the second, unfortunately, I'll be the broken record again. To the extent I have or have not learned anything in the litigation, I can't comment. And to say I didn't or I did would be to make a comment on what's in the record or not, and so I have to avoid that. Again, it was certainly a question that I think has been raised by others publicly and including some of the oral argument issues in Fisher, and it's an issue we're interested in. But, you know, unfortunately, I can't comment beyond that.
Well, I guess the question then is, where do you see us going from here if somebody identifies as a race, which they don't appear to be? Are we going to have testing?
If it were shown that someone, that individuals, I think the overall question about the existence of racial categories, how the schools, how broadly or narrowly they define them, who they lump together, and what mechanisms the schools have to verify whether someone is or is not a member of that racial group does go to the seriousness and compelling nature of the university's interest and whether that interest is narrowly tailored. If they don't know, and I'm not talking about necessarily the schools were involved in litigation, I'm speaking generally, if they don't know whether their system has integrity, so to speak, then I think that's an issue under strict scrutiny.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you, caller. We currently have one person waiting to ask a question. Again, if you would like to join the queue, please enter star, then the pound sign. Let's go to the next question.
Hi, this is Lenore. Can you comment at all about the arguments that have been used by the court in the past dealing with allowing the university autonomy in its internal decisions, which I suspect is where they go when they really feel that they can't make a decision on the grounds you've been mentioning?
Sure, Lorna, I appreciate the question. Certainly in Grutter, the majority did rely heavily on this idea of deference to the university to define its own mission. I think Fisher 1 clarified that to make clear that the university ought to only get deference with respect to having an interest in diversity, not the means by which they achieve that interest. And Fisher 2, I think, doesn't really add a lot to that equation because I read Fisher 2 to be more focused on the availability of data and information to test the university's need to use race and not about whether it has a sincere identified academic, so to speak, interest in racial diversity. To your point, practically speaking, that deference becomes a something that the court can rely on when the issue gets tough. I think there is a concern there. And certainly, I believe Justice Thomas and Justice Scalia in Grutter pushed back on this point that they should get deference. But we're hopeful that that won't become an impediment to reviewing the kinds of issues we've raised. But you know, I can't deny that that's something that will certainly be raised on the other side.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Will, currently our lines are wide open. If you'd like to ask an additional question, callers, please enter star, then the pound sign. I'm not seeing any questions currently, Will. I think we may have, we went through a lot of questions and you gave us a great update on the litigation. Is there anything you'd like to give us as sort of concluding remarks?
Just briefly, thanks everybody for taking the time to hear about our cases. They're active. I would encourage you to go to SFA's website and learn more about the organization if you're interested in it. Hopefully we can come back and do this down the road once we've made some further progress in the cases. But I appreciate the chance to give the update.
Excellent. We look forward to that update down the road. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank Will Consovoy for joining us today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.